This week we will have a guest, Harav Rabbi Leibowitz. He's the Mora, the Astra of the Beis HaKnesses of North Woodmere. He's a Magid Shir in Leif Shleima. He's a Musmuch of Hagoyin Reb Zalman Chaimya Goldberg. And I think he's the most popular Magid Shir, beloved and popular on Torah online. I think he has 3,000 or 4,000 shiurim. So this is really an incredibly successful and popular Magid Shir. And he's going to be speaking to Rav Daniel Feldman, who's Rosh Hashiva and Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. And the topic is social media in halacha, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, for all the millennials out there. What are the dinim of Lashon Hara on the internet? We've discussed this in the past. We're going to speak to somebody. He's going to speak to somebody who is absolutely an expert on it. He's Mechaber of many Sfarim, Reb Daniel Feldman, really an honor. Well, before we start, I would like to just, I want to remind us, you can listen to us, Matzah Shabbos, 7 to 12 midnight in WMCA, 570 AM. Monday morning, 11 a.m. at NachumSiegel.com. You can always get our podcast, www.headlinesbook.com, under the podcast section, or by hotline, 732-806-8700. You can email any questions or comments to info@headlinesbook.com. In the next few weeks, I will be doing another session devoted to answering emails. Before we start, I'd like to say, Avar, this week's Parsha, it talks about the Kruvim, that on top of the Aron, they put the Kruvim. What does Rashi say? What does Kruvim mean? Rashi says, Kruvim is Dmus Partsuf of Tinuk, a child, an angel, which is why in all the, you know, the pictures on top of the Kruvim, they have two angelic-looking, like, baby. And if you look in the Sifsei Chum, he says, well, how does Rashi know? Because in Aramaic, in Targum, a child is Kravya. So little angelic childs on top. But here's something interesting. In Parshas, in Chumash Bereishis, what does it say? Again, Kruvim, the Kruvim appear a second time in the Torah, but very differently. It says, Vayigoresh es Adam, he exiled man from Gan Eden, Vayashkein Mikedem le Gan Eden, and he placed in Gan Eden the Kruvim. What does Rashi say? Veslat hacherev Sapeches. In Gan Eden today, residing are the Kruvim. What does Rashi say? What are the Kruvim? Malachei Chavola. Angels of destruction. Interesting. The same word appearing twice. Once it's an angel, once it's an angel of destruction. What's going on over here? Let me suggest something. It says in the beginning of Malachim, it talks about David, who sadly had problems with a number of children, Avshalom, and now Adonio, his son. And it says about his son Adonio, he says he was beautiful. He was toiv toyar ma'od, just like Avshalom. And it says, le'atzavai aviv miyamav. His father never told him no. He never denied him anything. Lemar madua kacha asisa. He never saddened him. Atzavai is milashin atzav. He never, I guess, saddened him by telling him no. And what did he turn into? He turned into a monster who tries to kill his father. So here's something interesting. Which one is it? Is the Kruvya the child, the angel, or is it the Malachi Chavala? So is it possible to say? It depends. If the child is around, is on top of the Aron, right? He's Pyrus Knafav, he's Pyrus Talisai, he embraces, he adores, he is subjugated to the Aron, the Luchais, then the child is beautiful. But if on the other hand, the child is in Gan Eden, and in Gan Eden man got anything he wanted, there was no need to work really. Cakes grew on trees. It's a metaphor for all our fruit, the fruit of our labor really came without labor in Gan Eden. Then what happens to man? He becomes a malach of chavala, becomes an angel of destruction. And think of it. If we don't tell our children no, if we don't deny them anything, are we doing them a favor? If we don't teach them that delaying gratification is good. Did you read the story about the man, I think it was in Jersey, he weighed around 1,000 pounds, and they had to take out his living room window and with a crane hoist him out to get him to a hospital because they couldn't get him out the door, and no stretcher could carry him. And he said, they asked him, how did this happen? He says, I just loved Snickers. Snickers, right? So delaying gratification, understanding certain things aren't good, or you know what? The person who's never told no, the child who's never told no, it's not right. Work harder. I won't give you the answer. I won't help you figure it out, right? The person who never experiences frustration, what happens when they go out into the world? The world is a very nasty place, right? Could be. How is this person going to tolerate the disappointments? And no matter how successful or unsuccessful you are, one thing I guarantee you in life is disappointment. The Masilas Yesharim says, somebody who went 40 days without disappointment got Olam Haba in this world. So if we don't learn that obstacles are healthy, it's like lifting weights, they make us stronger. What does the saying go? It says, may your child have enough struggles to grow, but not so much that he gets broken. Right? Or may we have enough struggles so that we grow. So that's the answer. There's the malachi, there's the kruvim. There's a force, an energy that the Rabbeinu Shalom, that God sends to us and to our children every day. And we can use that energy to either be parts of Katina, beautiful angel, or if we embrace structure, meaning, enlightenment, Torah, halacha. On the other hand, if we just say, give me everything I can, I don't want to fight, I want to just get it as a gift, we're really creating a malach of chavala. Lesson from this week's parsha. Let's go to our really fantastic guest. I look forward to speaking to you again next week. This is David Lichtenstein for Headlines Radio.
Filling in for David Lichtenstein this week, and this week we have a very special opportunity to talk to Rabbi Daniel Feldman. Rabbi Feldman is a Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva University at Reitz. He's the Rav of a shul in Teaneck, Or Sadia, and has become a posek of national note, and is someone who's very widely respected in Orthodox circles throughout the country. Rabbi Feldman is a brilliant Talmud Chacham who also understands people very, very well. And to that end, he's dedicated an immense amount of energy to learning and teaching about how to properly interact with other people. In addition to his three Hebrew Sfarim, Bina B'Sfarim, he has also written three English Sfarim, which all focus on different elements of Bein Adam L'Chaveiro. His first book, The Right and the Good, his second book, Divine Footsteps, and most recently, the subject of tonight's talk, the third book, False Facts and True Rumors, which is about Lashon Hara in contemporary society, or as the tagline goes, Lashon Hara in contemporary culture. So we're going to speak with Rabbi Feldman about Lashon Hara issues that come up in modern times that maybe didn't come up so much in the past, as well as some age-old Lashon Hara issues that have always come up, but sometimes people are not as familiar maybe as we ought to be in how to handle a variety of situations. So with that, we welcome Rabbi Daniel Feldman to the line. Welcome, Rabbi Feldman.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Leibowitz, and thank you for that way overly generous introduction.
It's a pleasure to have you. Let's get right into it. I'll start with a situation that came up recently at a Shabbos table. We were sitting around a Shabbos table with a few families, and one of the families was going to soon be making a bar mitzvah, and they were talking about the potential caterers that they were going to use. Now, someone at the table immediately piped up and said, oh, that caterer, they're very, very nice, a very nice person, but they don't respond to your phone calls. They're not going to be attentive to you, but they'll get the job done in the end. Meaning immediately gave a review of a caterer in front of the whole table. Is that the proper way to respond? Should that information be kept private and not shared at all? Or is there some other way that's the best way to handle that situation?
Well, in terms of the first part, just whether it was proper to do it in front of other people, that's the hardest part, or the part that's least clear why that should be okay, because I think the discussion really focuses on how it may benefit somebody to whom it's relevant, and just the fact that maybe somebody else at the table may someday find it relevant doesn't seem like that's relevant enough concern to justify speaking in front of all of them. So certainly first say that if it should be said at all, it should be said more privately to the people who are in the parsha. And then the question is really just how relevant it is. I think the example that you gave is interesting because you're saying that essentially they're going to get their money's worth. They're going to get the job done. It's just a question of how pleasant an experience they'll have along the way. And that's kind of an interesting in-between area because theoretically we know that when something is going to provide a purpose and when it's going to save somebody from loss or wasting their money or certainly also feeling that a once-in-a-lifetime event is ruined, then there should be a imperative to warn them if that's really the case. So when we're talking about things on that level, then there is a strong case to be made that they should be informed about that. When it's not necessarily that, and it's a little more subjective, and it's not necessarily the kind of thing that's going to repeat itself, it gets a little bit more a matter of judgment. And I think it should be couched in a lot of caveats and put in a very careful context. It's interesting to note that when we consider issues of, let's say, giving a review, like you put it, a review of a business, which is a question of itself, you know, nowadays, so we have so many settings on the internet and elsewhere for one to post reviews of businesses. So I think theoretically, these things could be justified on a couple of grounds under the right circumstances. So when somebody's really looking at possibly losing out and possibly, certainly if they're going to be cheated or they're going to really be hurt in a significant way. So for sure, there is a need to warn people and to make sure they're not going to be victimized. I think there's also an in-between category that the Gemara in a few places, largely in Bav Metzia, for those who listen to Rabbi Leibowitz's Daf Yomi Shirim, and a few other places. So the Gemara talks about there are certain business situations where you're not necessarily able to extract money from somebody who did something wrong to you. It's a lower level kind of offense, but there's tarumas, which you would normally translate as a grievance. And it's an interesting question what that means. What's Chazal telling us when they say that you have a grievance? So it could mean that it means nothing. You just don't have any financial claim. But there's a Rashi in Bav Metzia, which some contemporary posts can call attention to, that says it means you can talk about it. And that sounds like it means that in addition to warning potential victims of really negative business practices, that there are lower-level offenses which you're also able to talk about in the right context because it's going to...
Is that a heter specifically in a circumstance where you have a personal grievance, where they did something to you? What if you know of something that they've done to somebody else?
It's a good question. I think that the logic that I'm assuming is associated with it would probably make sense no matter who they did it to. And I think the theme there is that it's not just that you can save someone from being victimized, but also we want to discourage bad business practices. And that if people know that their reputation is on the line, then they'll behave properly and they'll try to uphold high standards. So within a certain limited degree, it seems like there's an additional form of toelis here. It's not just saving people from being hurt, but also stopping people from taking advantage of others' goodwill and the like. So theoretically, there might be room for such reviews and for such comments. But we really have to be careful to make sure that everything we say is fair and accurate and put in context and is given part of a whole picture. One klal, I think, that comes up in a lot of these shilas, and I say this often, is that in Lashon Hara, we shouldn't think as much about the big issues, but more about the small issues. Which I mean that sometimes the question is, can you do business reviews? Can you write newspapers? Can you do certain other things? So the question isn't so much, can you do it in the first place? The question is, how do you go about doing it? Because very often there are many circumstances where these activities are justified and appropriate, but the details are what's important. So the most important thing is to make sure that whatever you're saying about this business is fair, is something that you know is real, is something that you know has an actual impact, is put in a context where everything else can be considered. And those are the bigger questions rather than a broad yes or no about whether these activities can be taken up in the first place.
Now, you've spoken a lot about putting your own reviews or writing your own things. Now, you know, we all know that when we go on something like Yelp or any of these business review type of websites, that not everybody lives up to the same standards of Lashon Hara. And there's certainly an issue of listening to Lashon Hara, reading Lashon Hara, being Makabel Lashon Hara. Should that prevent one from reading these reviews, even though they're the most efficient way to find out the information that you need to find out, knowing that much of it's going to be exaggerated or pot shots or things of that nature?
Well, I'd say there are a couple of impacts to the fact that these sites tend to be exaggerated. One impact is on the point that we just mentioned before, that if somebody does post on these sites, so one should also keep in mind that the context can be distorted. So as much as everything we're saying before, that theoretically there could be a justification for it, it's important also to note that they're weighing in an environment where things do tend to skew heavily negative, and to try probably to compensate for that in their assessment, maybe skew more positive or think very carefully about whether they want to participate in the forum in the first place because of the reality of how these things tend to play out. But in terms of reading them, so in terms of reading and listening to Lashon Hara, it's actually a little complicated. The fact is there is a serious prohibition of Kabbalah's Lashon Hara, of accepting it. The question is, what constitutes accepting it? So accepting it, the views on what constitutes Kabbalah, they range to, from on the one hand, to believing it, and beyond that, to not necessarily believing it, but more how you act on it. But it seems that Kabbalah's Lashon Hara doesn't specifically include just the very act of hearing or reading. Now, as the Chafetz Chaim points out, there clearly is a very small jump from hearing and reading to whatever constitutes the Isser of Kabbalah. So it's not a good idea to listen to Lashon Hara or to read Lashon Hara under normal circumstances, and maybe even is its own Isser, as the Chafetz Chaim discusses. But sometimes we have no choice if we need to be informed consumers and we only have access to information that comes from mixed sources. So then the responsibility really is to read it with more than a grain of salt, is to know that you're entering into a setting where things can be very, very distorted, and to try to really become educated consumers. I think that's really one of the increasing challenges of the internet era and of the information era in general, that there's so much going on around us, and from one hand, we have a greater need to be aware of what's going on, but on the other hand, so much of the information that we would draw from is tainted and is suspect and is not fair and balanced, and therefore we have to try to find a way, I think, to create a bigger space between reading and Kabbalah, you know, between listening and fully believing, and know that we may have to try to find whatever information we can sometimes, but also know that a lot of it is very, very iffy, and be very, very careful and try to develop a real sense of savvy in terms of what we accept.
Not to believe that everything we read on the internet is true.
Or even not to believe that a large percentage of it is true.
Right. Does it make a difference if it's a Jewish-owned business that's being reviewed or a non-Jewish-owned business?
I don't think so. I think practically speaking, if we're concerned about causing unfair harm, then that's a concern no matter what. It's not really clear that Lashon Hara distinguishes between Jews and non-Jews. There's a lot to discuss about that. But in any event, the value that we're talking about here, the concern that you're going to cause unjust harm, is a value no matter what. And we should be very careful to only create situations that are fair and that are just, and not to create problems for people, which can spread very quickly if we're not very judicious in how we do things. And I think that applies no matter who we're dealing with.
One can make the argument that that would be not only an issue of Kiddush Hashem, but also an issue of Ben Adam La'atzmo, and being a genuinely good person, regardless of who the person on the other end is.
Yeah, that's absolutely
that?
True. It's at least that. It's certainly at least that, yeah.
Right. Now, we both have the privilege of teaching college-age students who actually attend college classes. And one of the popular websites that I could be getting the name wrong, I think it's ratemyprofessor.com. I probably shouldn't be advertising until we get your answer.
Yeah.
But this is a website that's relied upon heavily, from what I understand, amongst college-age students, where they rate it, – it's exactly what Kishmo Kehu. It's exactly what it sounds like. They go and they rate their professors on a range of issues, how easy the class is, how hard the class is, how much work you'll have to do. Do they give the same tests every semester, how nice a person the professor is, and all sorts of things. And you can find, you know, whatever a typical student of, you know, or students of varying maturity would put there, but a lot of students find this to be a necessity. Well, what should our attitude toward that be?
I think it's a similar category to what we said before. Maybe I'm biased here as a teacher, but it's perhaps a little bit more so that theoretically, on paper, one can make a case for this if the issues are serious enough. But there's so much potential for abuse that it would make me very nervous, especially because we're dealing with settings in which people can comment anonymously. And it's so easy for an aggrieved student who can be aggrieved without any real basis to do a lot of damage. So it's possible on paper that there is what to work with here, but in the actual execution, I'd be very, very nervous that there is unjust damage being done to people's reputations. And certainly if somebody is posting on this, I would again encourage them to be exceedingly careful and to recognize that even if what they were saying is fair and balanced, the chances that it's also in a context in which there's a lot that's offsetting it is a high possibility. And also if one is reading this, to be aware that it's so easy for somebody who's not necessarily coming from such a balanced perspective to do a lot of harm and to be very, very careful.
I know my students have shared with me that it's almost become addictive, that at first you go on because you want to see if the teacher is an easy grader and will give them an easy A. But beyond that, and also if he's a good teacher, entertaining, but then they said you just love reading this stuff. It's just so entertaining to read what kids say about their professors. Even teachers are not even thinking about taking their classes. That would strike me as something that is wrong in the extreme, to just be
from a Mito's perspective, for sure, to cultivate a taste to read such things is definitely not the direction we want to go in. And as you were emphasizing before, that when it comes to Lashon Hara, we have a twin focus here. We have two tracks that are both equally important. One is that we're trying not to damage anyone unjustly, and we're trying not to create a personality that enjoys such things and that indulges in such things. And from what you're describing, it certainly seems that in addition to serious concerns in the first area, there's definitely concerns in the second area. It doesn't seem that there's any real reason why somebody should be reading about teachers that they're not considering taking, and certainly to develop a taste for it. It's hard
now,
to see how that...
Providing the platform, meaning if someone runs a blog where they post productive, thoughtful essays, or content on their blog, but it's an open comment section, and it therefore provides an open platform. Is that a problem for the blog administrator? Should they avoid leaving an open platform for people? It will engender a lot of productive discussion if it's a productive blog, but it could also lead to a lot of unnecessary anonymous Lashon Hara.
it's definitely an issue. The question is whether it's an issue that you can't work around, because we know that within Hilchos Lashon Hara, so we find that not only are we prohibited to say things that are bad about people, but we even have that surprising prohibition to say things that are good about people. And a number of the Rishonim understand that the issue is that if you say something that's nice, somebody who's listening might say, oh, really, you think he's so great? Let me tell you what I even know about this guy. And they're going to spill out a whole torrent of negativity. And we see from that halacha, I think, a number of things that are very relevant to the internet context. One is the fact that we're not just responsible for what we say, but we're also responsible for what we provoke in others to say, which is a serious concern. And this is an issue that's really magnified in the internet era, because it used to be that you can have a conversation with two or three friends and you know your audience, and you don't have to worry so much that if you're going to say something nice about someone, that one of these two or three friends is going to pipe up and argue something negative about that person. But now when you're dealing on the World Wide Web, and there's so many people who are out there watching, there's really nobody who's so parv that when you bring them up, that there isn't somebody with a Google alert for that name who's going to chime in and say, oh, you think he's so parv? Let me tell you how terrible he is. So we have a much more challenging environment as far as that's concerned. Doesn't mean, though, that there's nothing that we can do about it. I mean, one thing is that the blog administrator can keep a careful eye out for the kinds of comments and the kind of conversations that are taking place. And it's interesting also that Rabbeinu Yonah, I think, anticipated this many centuries ago, because Rabbeinu Yonah, in talking about the concern of saying good things about people, so he notes the fact that when you have a larger audience, it becomes more and more difficult, because the likelihood increases that there's going to be one person who's going to challenge it. So he suggests that a way to deal with that is to create a climate that conveys that that's not going to be welcome, and that whoever's going to take the conversation in that direction is going to themselves feel uncomfortable, because no one's going to want to go that way. So I think here also there is a climate, hopefully, that a blog administrator can create, and I think there are many who have been successful with that and making it clear that that's just not where they're going to let the conversation go. And if it does go there, they have the ability to delete it and to stop it. It's a tremendous responsibility, but it is possible to do it. And of course, when you allow the commenters to be anonymous, so there's no question that you're taking a much greater risk. That even when commenters aren't anonymous, they're at a very different level of guarding themselves. There's a very documented phenomenon called the online disinhibition effect that relates that when people are sitting behind a computer screen, not actually face-to-face with anyone, they find it much easier to engage in behavior that they would not be able to do if they actually were facing people, and to say things, to write things, to communicate in a way that really drops, as the name indicates, all inhibitions. And that's without anonymity. And certainly when people are anonymous and no one's going to know what they're doing, then there's really, really a concern that people can do all kinds of things. So somebody who's going to run a website that gives a platform for this, there's a way to do it responsibly, but they certainly have to be very careful.
Now, what about when there's a good reason to inform the public about a potential danger, whether it be a minor danger or a significant danger, or a predator of some sort? Even people who are bad people, one should not exaggerate or say more than is actually true or known to be true, I would imagine. But the way these things work is the most effective way to get the word out about somebody or some circumstance to avoid is through the internet, through Facebook, and people have shares and likes and comments, and it tends to spiral in a downward motion to the point that that people add whatever that they'll add. Is that something that should be taken into account when really doing it to, as a losamer al dam re'echa, to try to protect people initially, even knowing that everyone else who's going to respond or forward it may add their own comments and their own commentary?
You know, this is a good moment to point out that one of the core difficulties of Lashon Hara, and I think why there's been so much of a focus on studying Hilchos Lashon Hara really ever since the Chafetz Chaim wrote his Sefer, and why we have this mentality that it requires an enormous amount of our attention and focus, is that this is an area of halacha that's really uniquely tricky, and that everything is really a judgment call with tremendous consequences. And there's no question that Lo Samar Al Dam Re'acha is a humongous priority, and it seems to be one that hasn't really gotten enough attention perhaps in the past few decades. And already a long time ago, one of the Dayanim in Vilna, who I think was really a contemporary of the Chafetz Chaim, lived in the late 1800s, if I'm not mistaken, wrote in a sefer that was quoted in many later Sfarim, that everyone makes such a big deal about what they're not allowed to say, and people don't pay enough attention to what must be said. So that balance is one that is really tricky and has been the topic of a lot of discussion for a long time. And it takes a lifetime to really get it right. So here, on the one hand, Lo Samar Al Dam Re'acha, a huge priority. We really have to make sure that if somebody really is a threat, if somebody is a predator, then they shouldn't be allowed to do that without anybody being aware of it and without anybody being able to stop it. And whatever we can do to make sure it's not going to be exaggerated and to stop it from becoming a free-for-all is something that we try to bring a balance to as well. Usually it should be possible to do such things without resorting to anonymity, hopefully. So if people who are responsible and people who are known entities are the ones who lead this process, and if people begin to realize that they should only pay attention to the people who have established reputations for credibility, I think that potentially helps a little bit. So when they come out with a statement, it'll be known that this is something that has got weight to it and has reliability to it, and whoever adds on to it, and with anonymous comments or the like, maybe people will eventually realize to pay a little less attention to that. But it's a very, very tricky balance, and that's why I think this area of halacha requires a lifetime of learning, because it all boils down to a judgment call with very serious stakes on both sides, and we hope and pray that our judgment is refined enough that, and we have enough siyata d'shmaya, that we'll make decisions that are correct. But there's no question that as a community and as individuals, we've erred on both sides of the equation many, many times.
Yeah, and with consultation with Rabbanim and Gedolei Yisrael, I would imagine, depending on the size of the situation, it's critical. Just moving to the other side of it, you know, someone who's been victimized, I could certainly think of several examples. One recent one comes to mind of a very, very fine rabbi who does things l'shem shemayim and was just a victim of a highly orchestrated attack, you know, using all sorts of social media.
Yeah.
How does someone properly
very fine
react? Yeah, how does someone properly react to something like that? It's very hard not to fire back, especially knowing what you know about the person who's orchestrating a terrible attack. Is it proper to fire back so that the person not get away with it, or is it always just better to be quiet and let it be? How does one handle a situation like that?
I think it is necessary to establish the truth, because the consequences of not doing that sometimes can be far worse, even if one is such a tzaddik that he's able to say, let it all pass. But if he doesn't establish where the truth is, it can really spiral out of control. And in terms of responding, it doesn't necessarily require going after the character of the person who's making the attacks. Sometimes it's necessary, sometimes it's not. But to make sure that the attack on the person who's trying to defend himself, that this person doesn't let that damage happen, is an important priority. The Chafetz Chaim, in one place, seems to indicate that even when you're defending yourself, you shouldn't identify who's doing the damage, and that a real Baal Nefesh will just absorb the issue himself. But it's not clear what type of situation he's talking about there. It seems like he's talking about very minor things where there isn't really any cost to just letting it pass without actually taking on the issue. But when it's something that's more serious, then for sure it seems that there's real damage that can be done if you don't stand up for yourself and establish the truth. And even the Chafetz Chaim's position that there is any mila to absorbing it is a topic of a lot of discussion. The Sefer of Shalos and Tshuvos that came out, I think just last year, a year or two ago, 2015 maybe, Tshuvos Bo Toshiv has a whole essay about this, about trying to figure out if the Chafetz Chaim is the only position on this, that there is any mila to absorbing the attack. It's an arguable position to begin with. But even within the Chafetz Chaim, it seems like he means when it's something relatively minor, but if somebody is really going to try to damage you, I think it is necessary to try to establish what the truth is and to try to make sure that that damage doesn't stick, and that is something that we should allow the person to do without having to worry about what the consequences will be on the one who's initiating that attack. And it's interesting, there is a statement in the Yerushalmi, which is subject to a lot of discussion, but it's still an important principle. It says that it's mutter l'saper l'shon hara bali machlokas. So people, it sounds like it means people who are troublemakers. So we have license to do something in relation to that. And it's a big discussion whether that's a limited heter, whether it's a broader heter, whether it's only when one is directly trying to quiet what they're doing or whether it goes beyond that. The Chasam Sofer, in his commentary to Moed Katan, has a fascinating comment where he kind of adds a word there, and he says, Bal Machlokas Shelo, meaning it's not necessarily a troublemaker in general, but somebody who has an issue with you. People should be aware that they're not necessarily reflecting an unbiased perspective. So I think there are a lot of support sources that indicate that one can and perhaps should defend oneself and not let these things happen without any kind of a correction. We know that the Gemara in Bav Metzia about Anos Devarim tells us that David HaMelech was the target of attacks, people trying to embarrass him, and he responded with the famous comment that somebody who's involved with a Safek Eishes Ish is Chayiv Misa, but can do tshuva and go to Olam Haba, but somebody who tries to embarrass somebody else in public has no chelik in Olam Haba. And it sounds like, from the way that Gemara presents that, that this was basically his retort back to the person who was trying to embarrass him, and presumably it embarrassed that guy. But it sounds like that's a legitimate approach. So I would say that there's a importance and a need to make sure that such campaigns don't go without a response, especially if there is the potential and the possibility that they're really going to do harm.
Yeah, well, we often find that knowing when to speak Lashon Hara and when it's really a toelus and when one is supposed to is often the greatest challenge. Someone once told me that they had asked Rav Saraya Gablitsky, who was mayor, about himself. He said about himself that he hadn't spoken Lashon Hara in 60 years. And someone said, isn't that hard? And he said, no, once you get in the swing of it, it's not so hard. The hard part is speaking Lashon Hara L'Toelas when you have to. That's the really tricky part. That seems to often be the case. Shifting gears a little bit, every discussion of Lashon Hara always involves various citations of the Chafetz Chaim. He really did a tremendous amount of work, obviously, in Shmir Salashon, the Sefer Chafetz Chaim, putting together all the Mar Makomos about Lashon Hara. Do Poskim take the attitude toward the Chafetz Chaim because of that, because he did all of that work that no one else had done, that he is sort of the Posek Acharon, the final word on everything related to Lashon Hara, or are things still open to debate where there are disagreements amongst Poskim? And if it is open to debate, what are some of the issues that people do disagree with the Chafetz Chaim about in Hilchos Lashon Hara?
I think there's really a fascinating world of literature that has developed around the Sefer Chafetz Chaim. It's possibly unique in halacha, that there are a number of really beautiful svarim that are about Lashon Hara, or more often specifically commentaries to the Chafetz Chaim. I'm looking at my shelf right now, seeing just svarim that are on the Chafetz Chaim. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, just commentaries on the Chafetz Chaim. And a lot of them take a really fascinating tone, that on the one hand there is a tremendous reverence, as you would expect, and a tremendous appreciation, and really treating him like a Rishon or more in terms of his authority. But I think there is a readiness to disagree on a lot. In a lot of ways he did kind of start the conversation, but there are issues that are debated, and debated with a tremendous reverence, and always with a very extended effort to try to figure out exactly where the Chafetz Chaim is coming from, and what's his basis, and can we be matarist, what he's saying, but at the same time, a recognition that sometimes there are issues that have to be looked at from many different angles. And a lot of it has to do with the question, really the central issue in so much of Lashon Hara, in terms of the balance of Toelas and where that balance lies and what to emphasize, and especially the Chafetz Chaim's requirement of a number of conditions that have to be satisfied before one speaks Toelas. And are those conditions always necessary, and under what circumstances? So there's a lot of discussion about that. Or, for example, one of the commentaries on the Chafetz Chaim, which I kind of get the sense that this is among the commentaries, the most respected of the commentaries. And in this sefer, he notes that he thinks, a point I alluded to earlier, that nowadays we're living lives that are so intertwined with each other, and everything that we do affects everyone else, and everything that everyone else does affects us, that there's a greater need to know what's going on with other people than there was once upon a time, and that perhaps changes the parameters of Toelis a little bit. And he writes that he doesn't think...
Who says that?
That's in the Sefer Nesiv Chaim. Rav Moshe Kaufman is author of a Sefer on the Chafetz Chaim that has a number of sections to it called Nesivos Chaim, Nesiv Chaim, Zera Chaim. And he makes a comment there that he's not sure the Chafetz Chaim would agree with him on that point, but that he thinks it's true anyway. And so I think there is kind of a very healthy discussion where there's a lot of recognition of the incredible stature of the Chafetz Chaim and tremendous amount of deference to that, but a willingness to really go through the issues and to see this as a major ongoing discussion. And outside of those farim, there are many others. The Chazon Ish argues in the Chafetz Chaim on a number of important points, which becomes the topic of a lot of later discussion. There were a couple of points that in Hilchos Lashon Hara that became major battleground issues. Even beyond the Sefer Chafetz Chaim, Reb Moshe's psak that a teacher shouldn't elicit information from one student about other students because the teacher will be training the child in Lashon Hara, and many others strongly disagreed and said that the teacher's job is to convey the nuances of the balance between Lashon Hara and Los Amod, and how could you say such a thing? And then Reb Moshe doubled down, and another tshuva became quite a back and forth.
Right. I had a conversation with a Rosh Yeshiva once who said something that startled me a little bit. He said that he thinks that the Sefer Chafetz Chaim should not be read as a halacha sefer, but as a musar sefer. And as far as halacha, we don't, it's not necessarily written to be taken so literally. I mentioned that to a different Rosh Yeshiva who thought that was wild and that could not possibly accept that when the Chafetz Chaim says there are this many conditions to this situation, he means that literally, and one has to check off the checklist to make sure that they are following it to the T. What's your impression about the attitude when reading Sefer Chafetz Chaim?
I think it's somewhere in the middle, because first of all, the Chafetz Chaim also wrote other svarim about Lashon Hara that were meant to be the Musar svarim. He wrote Shmiras HaLashon, he wrote a lot of other works that were meant to be the Musar works. It's hard to say that he didn't believe this to be a halacha sefer, and it's also important to point out that some feel that he really started the whole halachic focus on Lashon Hara, and I find that a little bit hard to see, considering that the Rambam and others did lay down psakim in Hilchos Lashon Hara, and that clearly some of the sugyas in Shas, there's so many statements in the Gemara, some of them are more agadic in nature, but many of them are very technical and halachic. The sugyas about Kabbalah Lashon Hara and other such things, it really sounds like the Gemara is certainly coming at it from a halachic perspective. So it's hard to say the Chafetz Chaim didn't intend it as a halachic sefer, nor was he the first to treat it in a halachic way. But I think that also leaves room for questioning exactly how he did so. I think he did us a tremendous service in focusing us to see it with that kind of weight and that kind of seriousness, and recognizing that this isn't an area that's just for tzaddikim and just for aspirational Musar values, but something that has real consequences and real principles. And I think we have a continuation of that service by seeing all of these mechabrim who have came at it with equal seriousness and tried to figure out exactly whether or not all of his conclusions necessarily bring things to a helpful place or not, or bring things to the place that is not questionable, but it's a crucial part of the discussion. So I think it's one thing to say that the Chafetz Chaim is halachic sefer. I think it is. It doesn't necessarily mean that he's the final word on everything. I don't think that. I think there are many gedolim that clearly felt there was a lot to go back and forth about, and that's a part of the Mochamta Shel Torah that we have in really every area. So I think there isn't really any area where we think matters are totally closed, so this shouldn't be any different. But the Chafetz Chaim really opened up a fascinating level of discussion, and just the tone that continues through these Sfarim, who I think so many of them really have found a very beautiful balance between an appreciation and a reverence for what the Chafetz Chaim did, while still being ready to question and to analyze and to give it very serious thought, makes this area a particularly beautiful area for extended study.
Right. Well, one of the more delicate balances that's hard to keep is in celebrating Purim. It's traditional in yeshivos that they have a Purim spiel, or what they used to call a Purim Rav, where they would essentially make fun of the Rosh Yeshiva or the rebellion by exaggerating some of their tendencies and the nuances of their speech. We know in terms of Dinei Hezek, in terms of damaging in Purim, there are some relaxations of the halacha, maybe in terms of cross-dressing. There are a few issues that maybe there's a relaxation of the normal halachas for Purim. Is there any such Purim heter when it comes to Lashon Hara or Onas Devarim, or just giving an impression of a caricature of someone who's a respected Talmud Chacham, or even not a respected Talmud Chacham in that context?
So here, this is a topic that was a tremendous machlokas, is a tremendous machlokas, and I have a bias on this topic, so I have to be honest about it. But there were a number of great poskim who took tremendous...
I think Rabbi Feldman's referring, just the listeners may not know what the bias is, that Rabbi Feldman is sort of a legendary performer in the Purim Spiel in Yeshiva University, and certainly Be'er Shechter, but Marin of Rabbeinu. So I assume that's the bias you're referring to?
Yeah, so it's it's a topic that was tremendously controversial, because there are a number of poskim in writing that you can find. Rav Adi Yosef and a few others, Rav Pam has some comments in the Atara Lamelech, where they're very against spiels, and they're understandable concerns, everything that you just listed. Rav Moshe Sternbach has a few comments, there are a lot of statements you can find in some 20th century poskim where they were very, very concerned, to say the least, about Purim spiels. And at the same time, there's clearly a tradition that allows them and encourages them. And as I mentioned, in our own yeshiva at YU, Rav Shechter has commented in the past that YU was founded by people who came over from Volozhin. So we have all the Menhagim from Volozhin. So it's brought in the history books that in Volozhin, in the days of the Netziv, and when Rav Kook was a young student in Volozhin, that this is what they had there also. They had the spiels that are along the lines of the spiels that we're familiar with today, as it's described in the books. And clearly that was the accepted practice there, and in Tells and a number of other yeshivas where there are records and stories about such practices. So clearly this is a a concept about which there is a elu ve'elu, is a machlokas among Klal Yisrael, those who...
Would you think that maybe it's a little different nowadays that often these spiels are then put on YouTube? I mean, I was once at a, just to give an example, I was once at a Purim spiel, not one that you were in, that board members and parents of students were there in the room, and for those students in the school, when they were making fun of a particular Rebbe, it wasn't me, it was somebody else, but when they were making fun of a particular Rebbe, you know, for those students in the school, they knew this Rebbe was an excellent Rebbe, and they were just overly exaggerating a certain tendency that he had in a manner of speech. But if I'm a parent or a board member and I haven't sat in that Rebbe's classroom, I would think the kids have no idea what he's talking about, and it could really be damaging. So the fact that very often you find that these Purim spiels end up on YouTube, is that a cause of greater concern?
Well, the greater publicity and permanence that comes with the internet is always a reason to take everything more seriously, and is always a reason to be even more careful than we ever have been with these things. But there's no question this is a high-risk activity, which is one reason why it should really always be done with rabbinic supervision. And hopefully the control over the YouTube posting. I certainly know instances where certain bits have been performed and then have been edited out of the YouTube posting because it was decided it shouldn't go any farther. And clearly that's not always possible. So there's no question it definitely raises the stakes. So there is a tremendous care that has to be brought, and not everyone is capable of it. There's no question that it's something that is a high-risk activity. Just to try to address why it is that in our yeshiva and other yeshivas we seem to have embraced this practice and have not adopted the position of the poskim who thought it was not even something to consider. So I think it's not necessarily comparable to what you mentioned before about the fact that we find Rishonim saying that on Purim and maybe other times also when there's an atmosphere of celebration, so there's an implicit mechila, let's say, in terms of property damage that comes along with that because we want people to be able to have a good time. So we assume that people are a little bit less makbid on things. So that probably doesn't help us enough because that works for mamono. So I can say, all right, I'm not going to sue you if you spill some wine on my carpet on Purim. But personal anguish probably doesn't work that way. Probably isn't given to mechila in that sense. It could be mochel somebody after the fact, but to be mochel somebody in advance and say that my feelings are nothing, that's not something that we really find in halacha, probably. So I think the basis for the heter, to the assumption that there is one, the assumption that we work off of, is a case that can be built on comments you find in some of the Rishonim, that sometimes there's an environment where it's clear from the environment that what's happening is not derogatory and is not negative. And I think if we're successful, and I like to hope that we have been, if we're successful in creating an atmosphere where it's understood that this is an expression of love rather than derision, and that this is the way we show our affection, and that no one takes it as anything other than that, then hopefully that's what mitigates the issues and that's what makes it a positive environment. And together with the fact that many great Rosh Yeshiva have felt that if it's not doing harm, then it contributes to creating a bond between the teachers and the students and perhaps a healthy outlet. So assuming that all those premises are true, I think that's what we work off of. But it certainly takes a lot of care, and it really should be done only with great sensitivity.
If every yeshiva had a Rabbi Feldman to do their Purim spiels, the world would be a better place. That was my comment. You don't have to comment on that.
Definitely not going to comment on that one.
I'll just ask maybe two more questions, and I appreciate all the time that you're giving us. First, the use of Facebook and Twitter and social media in general, I don't have much experience with it. I mean, I happen to be on Twitter, but not on Facebook at all. But even from my limited use of Twitter and my very guarded use of Twitter, following very few people and, you know, really just trying to keep it to Divrei Torah and inspiring stories, there's always things that you shouldn't be hearing or seeing or mockeries that are made, and you try to unfollow anyone who would post something like that. But it's the nature of the medium that these things come through. On the other hand, people will say that in order to function in today's society, in order to market one's business, in order to, one has to be on Facebook and Twitter. Is it worth it? Is it worth the trade-off, even in the most guarded situation?
I'd like to hope that in the most guarded situation, in the most careful situation, there is a lot of good that people could do. One thing that really surprised me, in order not to say anything unfair or unjust, I'm not going to name which one of the platforms it is, but I had a negative experience with one of the platforms that it seemed to be that they allow people to take on the identities of other people and pretend to be them, and some kind of a parody Heather, apparently, but it can often come across as if they are the real person. And that was amazing to me. You know, that seems like that's just really a pure hezek and slander. And certainly, I think no one should cooperate with that. But beyond that, there are, as you say, a lot of risks. But I'm not sure that they're not manageable. You're right that the medium lends itself to it, and that's something that one has to be very sensitive to. I think that our whole mindset has shifted with the way we interact and communicate, and that doesn't mean that we can't do any good with it, but it means that there are all kinds of new challenges and dulling of our sensitivities that requires a lot of attention. And it's also not even just about Lashon Hara, it's also about Onos Devarim, that we say things that are painful that we wouldn't imagine saying face-to-face, even just like, for example, if Chas V'Shalom, a tragedy of some kind is reported on a news site, and you see the comments that people put there, well-meaning people, it seems, but people just totally forget that other people are going to see these comments, and perhaps, Rahman al-Atlan, grieving people are going to see comments of such insensitivity that I can't imagine they would ever say face-to-face. And it's just a whole different mentality that we really have to work hard to hold on to the sensitivities that we need to have, and together with also a loss of an appreciation for the role of privacy, which is interesting how that is its own area. We know that even Bilam praised the Jewish people for having a sense of tznius and how they structure their dwellings, and that's something that we're kind of losing track of also. And that has implications in all kinds of different ways. It has implications for kinna and for provoking jealousy in other people. And there are a lot of ways in which maybe we are forgetting sometimes some of the core midos that are crucial for upholding our national values. And it doesn't mean that these settings are impossible to use, but it means that we really have to think very hard about whether what we're doing is consistent with all of the ideals that we have for ourselves. And sometimes it means we need to take a break from these atmospheres. Sometimes it means a long break. And sometimes it means just a constant questioning of, have we shifted in ways that are really not helpful?
When I advise people on how to handle certain social media platforms, the ones that I'm not on, I can't really advise. I don't know enough about them. But certainly, let's say, with something like Twitter, I would always say only follow people who will not post anything that you shouldn't be reading, and unfollow them as soon as they do. As soon as they do post something they shouldn't be reading. And I think another important element is that a lot of times people will use the platform to just self-promote, to just talk about all the great things that they're doing, which is really not a reflection of really great midos. I mean, gaiva is like the worst mida. So people should be cognizant of it, because it's the whole nature of the platform, is that's what people use it for, to just promote themselves.
To do that.
Yeah.
It's very easy to forget about what's a normal way of interaction and what's what's not
right.
Going to be consistent with creating a refined personality.
Yeah. Well, one last question, and this is sort of open-ended, but if you could identify maybe one or two of what you believe are the greatest misconceptions that are out there about the halachos of Lashon Hara, that people just have it backwards or they have it wrong about, what would come to mind?
I would say three come to mind. One, I mean, they're not. None of them are going to be so shocking, I think, or at least the first one or two are not going to be so shocking. One is it's the balance between Toelis and Lashon Hara, which is so often backwards that you very often find that people come at this completely the opposite way, that when they know something is not going to make much of a difference, so they're happy to speak Lashon Hara all day and all night. But as soon as something may actually impact something important, when maybe it should impact something, all of a sudden people get very nervous to say anything, and maybe those are the contexts in which they should be saying something. So very often you find people having the exact opposite approach to issues of Toelis and Lashon Hara that they should, that they're ready to say a lot of things when it's not justified, and then as soon as it becomes consequential in a way that maybe it's necessary to say something, all of a sudden they don't want to talk anymore. And that's probably the biggest area.
You find that in Shiduchim a lot.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, for sure. Shiduchim I have a lot more to say about. I think if you want to talk about misconceptions in Shiduchim, it's a whole, I'll have to come on your show a whole other time. But that people, I would say, you know, it's important. That also people get completely backwards. So I'm going to add another one to my list just to unload about that. But I think that people don't say what's necessary when somebody really could be a danger and really could make life miserable for someone. So people hold back on that. But then they do a phenomenal amount of damage when they comment on, oh, whether your personalities will get along, or things that they can't possibly know. And you have to really, really have actual nevuah to predict how people are going to get along in these very subtle ways, whether they'll find each other interesting. Nobody knows that, and people are so ready to both offer their comments and to listen to their comments. The fact that people make decisions not to go out with someone because someone else said, oh, my sister said that we're not going to find our personalities interesting, I think that's genuine Lashon Hara. I mean, that's just the harm that's done from those kind of conversations is really unbelievable. That's another one. The third one, I would say, what I said before, is that people think about these questions in terms of the big questions rather than the small questions. Again, I think our questions shouldn't be so much, can you write book reviews or product reviews or newspapers, as much as how do we do all these things? That should always really be the question. Focus more on the little questions than on the big questions. And another major misconception I think we have is that, you know, we learn in grade school that Lashon Hara means that we shouldn't say bad things even if they're true. So the way we often relate to that is, okay, we shouldn't say negative facts about people, that such and such happened or this event happened or someone did this or whatever it is. So that's true, that that's a concern. But the much bigger issue, which I think is what Lashon Hara really is about, is that we take these true kernels and we editorialize about them, and we put our spin on them, and we offer our opinions as if that's a fact. And I think that's really what we mean when we talk about disparaging people with things, even if they're MS. It means going beyond the facts. So, for example, if we look at the main case of Lashon Hara in the Torah, is the case of Miriam speaking about Moshe. And there, it's not that she related some fact to Aaron that he didn't know before. It's that they were talking about it and offering their take on it. And that's where we really find the aver of Lashon Hara. And I think the examples in Shas, too, when the Gemara talks about cases that are Lashon Hara, it's very often not saying, oh, that somebody informed the other one about something that happened. It's about their comment about it and their interpretation and their spin. And these are things that we're so ready to offer that we think, oh, we know why people did things and what they were thinking and what this reflects. And I think that's really where a lot of actual, genuine Lashon Hara Daraisa takes place, and we don't perceive it as such. We think that it's more about saying that X, Y, and Z happened, that was the Isser of Lashon Hara, when really the Lashon Hara was when we said, this happened, and it happened because so-and-so was thinking this, or really wants to do that, or doesn't care about this, or whatever we followed up with, that's really where the real Chumras HaAveira lies.
That's an excellent list. I really appreciate that. And we appreciate you very much coming on, taking so much time to enlighten us about all of these detailed halachas of Lashon Hara, and certainly gives us a lot to work on, a lifetime of work to be able to master all of this. Thank you very much, Rabbi Feldman.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Leibowitz. I'll take any excuse to speak to you for an hour.
Take care.
Please keep up the wonderful work. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Galton.